crash, pass, mass, blast the system. We wanna get it hype, get it live, get with the mission. We run the crowd loud, this pumping rhythm is hitting. We wanna make it clear, we ain't scared. This is the vision we want, we want.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the rise of America's secret government. We'll be joined for the hour by New York Times bestselling author David Talbot. We'll be talking about his new book, The Devil's Chessboard. Please stay with us.
Commodities or cards that turn the global economy. We're the promise of a legacy, a spirit we're honoring. An anomaly to those who can't imagine a world without oppressive forces, slavery for almighty dollar bills. We won. We got the love of the Thought Brothers and our sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got that love of the Thought Brothers and your sisters. The people together can overthrow the system. We got the love of the Thought Brothers and our sisters.
By criminal minds, political ties, habitualized, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burned bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys, and the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the bridges and the levees and the mines.
Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Today, we're joined for the hour by best-selling author David Talbot. We'll be talking about his new book, The Devil's Chessboard. That's on Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the rise of America's secret government. People that listen to the Project Censored Show know that we've long covered these affairs, certainly the work of Peter Dale Scott and the Deep State. We've also covered a lot on the JFK assassinations with Jefferson Morley, with Mark Lane, Oliver Stone and Peter Cousins, Nick and others. And it is an honor to have on air with us today David Talbot. So, Peter Phillips, please introduce our guest today.
David Talbot is the author of the New York Times bestseller, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, and the national bestseller, Season of the Witch, Enchantment, Terror, and Deliverance. His new book is The Devil's Chessboard, about Alan Dulles. David is the former senior editor of Mother Jones, a former feature writer of San Francisco Examiner, has written for The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, Time Magazine, The Guardian, and other major publications. Welcome, David.
Great to be here.
David, talk about this book. It's history. It's about Dulles. A lot of people don't know the history of Foster and Alan Dulles and their impacts that they had, certainly after World War II, with Foster being at the State Department under the Eisenhower administration and Alan being the head of the CIA. So they had a tremendous power, and they were law firm together in New York and represented major clients all over the world. Why do this book? Why do this history?
Because simply this is the backstory to everything that we're wrestling with today, whether it's torture, extraordinary rendition, the mass surveillance of private citizens, extra-legal assassinations, all these things that we thought had originated after 9/11 under the Cheney and Rumsfeld regime and Bush regime really have their origins during the Cold War regime of Alan Dulles, who in many ways was a mentor and an inspiration for men like William Casey, the lawless CIA director of Ronald Reagan, and on up through Cheney and Rumsfeld and to today, with the CIA director John Brennan selecting who we should kill every day, essentially, with his drone program. This is all the dark legacy of Alan Dulles. And so for Americans to understand what we're going through today and where we're headed for the future, it's essential for us to understand this past.
David Talbot, let's go back to the post-World War II years, 1947, the founding of the CIA itself, and then the subsequent Truman presidency in 48, where he was elected in his own right against Dewey. Can you talk a little bit about the relevance of the National Security Council report, NSC 68, and how that was kind of some of the foundation for what later becomes Truman Doctrine, detente, and what the role the Dulles brothers play in this?
There's always a struggle from the very beginning over what the concept of our national security system should be coming out of World War II. And Alan Dulles, who defied President Roosevelt during the war by negotiating secretly with our Nazi enemies while he was stationed in Switzerland with the OSS, which was our wartime spy service, he already has a history of defying presidents and of determining his own policy. Not him himself, by the way, but as part of this network we've been talking about of power based on Wall Street and the national security system in Washington, the oil industry, and other corporate clients of the Dulles brothers. And so 1947, when Truman signs this bill creating the CIA, you know, his intention, as he stated very clearly, Harry Truman, was to create an agency that would provide him with information, just an intelligence gathering agency, and provide him with the best information that he needed to make his decisions as president. He had no intention of creating what he later called a Gestapo, a covert cloak and dagger organization going around the world, overthrowing governments, assassinating people, and so on. And he made this very clear, by the way, years later when he was retired. He wrote an astonishing op-ed piece in the Washington Post soon after the Kennedy assassination in December 1963. And in it, he said he feared he had created a Frankenstein, that the CIA was out of control, that it was threatening not only democracy abroad, but democracy at home, which was a startling thing for this former president who had created the CIA to say.
Certainly, Alan Dulles was adamantly anti-communist, and his feelings in that regard are certainly anti-Russian and Soviet and Stalin, but his feelings in that regard pushed him into a direction of rather diabolical arrangements, certainly with Nazis, assassinations, and ultimately a counter to the Kennedy administration in very severe ways. Could you talk about some of his relationships with Nazis during the war and after?
This is, I think, one of the most startling things in my book, and it really hasn't been fully reported until now. We've been getting bits and pieces of this, but the full extent of the collaboration between men like Dulles, who were at the top of our national security system, and the Nazi regime. It began, of course, before the war, when the Dulles brothers were at this law firm on Wall Street, Sullivan and Cromwell, the most powerful law firm in the United States. And among their clients are a number of German corporations, including IG Farben, the chemical conglomerate that manufactured Zyklon B, the notorious gas that was used to exterminate Jews at the death camps. They had no compunctions about dealing with these men, even as the war begins. And as, in fact, Dulles has himself sent to Switzerland during the war because he knew in Switzerland he would have very little supervision from Washington because Switzerland had been cut off from the outside world by Nazi forces. He used that kind of sanctuary as a way to continue dealing with many of his German contacts. Their loot was being laundered in Swiss banks. Alan Dulles was part of that. His good friend Tom McKittrick ran something called the Bank of International Settlements, which was one of the major Nazi financial mechanisms during the war for laundering their money and then buying the essential materials they needed for their war machine. Alan Dulles looked the other way while that was happening and, in fact, you know, collaborated with that. He was more intent on meeting with Nazi representatives from Hitler's regime and trying to find a way to cut a separate deal with them that would keep much of the Third Reich intact after World War II as a bulwark against the Soviet Union, which Alan Dulles and his allies in U.S. national security always felt was enemy number one, not the Nazis. And so, in fact, in direct defiance of FDR and his policy of unconditional surrender, Dulles does indeed cut this deal with the Nazi forces in Italy in the final days of the war that saves the necks of a number of these top Nazi war criminals.
David Talbot, you actually have a chapter in your new book, Devil's Chessboard, called Brain Warfare, and you're kind of hinting around this right now in the collaboration with the Nazis, which I know, as someone that teaches history, it's always interesting to bring this up in the U.S. history classes. A lot of students still, they just have no idea that the United States actually collaborated. Well, first of all, there were American industrialists like Henry Ford and companies like IBM that actually assisted the Nazis, helped support some of the Nazi efforts for some time, Bush's grandparents and the Brown Little Bank and these kind of things. They're, of course, astonished to hear that, but they're even more astonished to hear about some of the programs that went on. Could you talk a little bit about the involvement of CIA and perhaps Dulles in some of the things happening, actually from World War II, Gehlen Org, but then moving over into the United States, particularly Operation Paperclip. You do mention that briefly in the book. Could you talk a little bit about that and some of these programs?
In the final days of the war, there's this amazing drama drama going on, sort of spy versus spy drama in Italy and other places, where some very dedicated military professionals, intelligence professionals on our side in the U.S. Army intelligence, and I interviewed one of these people who was a young man at the time in Rome, were trying their best to track down these escaping war criminals as they fled Germany to bring them to justice. But just as quickly as they would round up these war criminals, these Nazis would be let out the back door by people like Dulles and his top people like James Jesus Angleton, who later goes on to become the very powerful head of counterintelligence for the CIA. So these were the so-called Nazi rat lines, the escape routes that ran over the Alps down into Italy and then overseas. And, of course, Adolf Eichmann himself escaped that way, one of the engineers of the final solution of the Holocaust, and was later tracked down by Israeli agents, of course, and brought to justice in Jerusalem. But most of these people were not tracked down and were not brought to justice, and they did end up in some cases in the United States even, where if they had special expertise, they were thought to know inside information about the Soviet enemy, or if they were rocket scientists, of course they were given sanctuary in the U.S. Now what my book brings out is something I think even more horrific, which is due to men like Alan Dulles, some of the most notorious war criminals were not only saved from prosecution at Nuremberg, but they were reinstalled in power in post-war democratic West Germany. The top spymaster on the Eastern Front for Hitler, notorious official named Reinhard Gehlen, cuts a deal with Dulles. And as a result, Dulles helps install him as the top spymaster for Konrad Adenauer's government in post-war West Germany. They wine him and dine him for years. They bring him to the United States, this Nazi Gehlen. They bring him to their clubs. They even give him tickets to the last game of the World Series because it turned out his Nazi deputy, former Nazi, was a big American baseball fan. So they see Joe DiMaggio play his last game in the 1951 World Series in New York. So, you know, it was a sinister alliance, and it had terrible effects because, among other things, Gehlen was a terrible spymaster. His organization, which was known originally as the Gehlen Organization and then became the formal spy agency for West Germany, was penetrated by the Soviets. They knew everything he was doing. He fed the U.S. false estimates of Soviet military strength, which actually fed fire into the Cold War paranoia. So not only was he sinister, his ideology, because he believed in exterminating the enemy completely. He was a kind of Dr. Strangelove-like figure, but he also was a bad spy.
That's quite an amazing story. I think, David, what I enjoyed so much about your book was how you bring the personal lives of people into the historical process. And when you bring somebody in, you tell their whole story and how they ended up their lives, and it makes it real. It makes it sort of consuming. So I love that aspect. Certainly, I love that aspect of the book. Talk a little bit about the anti-Semitism that was in kind of the social register elites and the Wall Street, Dulles' circle, the Rockefellers and that kind of looked the other way as they knew the Jewish Holocaust was going on in Europe.
I think it wasn't a case of overt or extreme anti-Semitism with people like Dulles, but I call it a kind of reflexive, waspy, gentlemanly anti-Semitism that was very prevalent in these circles, at the State Department and the national security circles and so on. They just did not feel, really, the human plight of the Jews to the extent that they needed to take action that could have saved the Jews. And there was, of course, as we know, a raging battle within the Roosevelt administration about how aggressive the United States should be in intervening and perhaps bombing the train lines to the concentration camps or the camps themselves. And Dulles was in a great position in Switzerland to be picking up on the earliest reports from Hitler's Germany, his empire, and what was happening. And he was indeed getting these reports from German heroes who were at great risk to their own lives, crossing the border into Switzerland, smuggling in documents showing that Hitler had begun to build the infrastructure for the final solution and that Jews were being rounded up and were being sent to these camps. But instead of sending this on to Washington in cables, marked urgent, he basically sat on them. This is Dulles. Instead, he was interested in other things about hearing about Germany, like how strong was the Communist Party in the underground and in Hitler's Germany? You know, would the left be emerging from World War II as still a strong force in West Germany and so on? The plight of the Jews simply had little impact on Dulles. He was a cold, calculating man who was overwhelmingly focused on sort of the strategic issues that he thought we should be focusing on coming out of World War II, i.e. the Cold War and how to fight the Soviet Union.
You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with best-selling author David Talbot about his new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. We'll continue our discussion with David Talbot after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We continue our conversation with David Talbot. He's the author of Brothers and also most recently The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government. Before the break, we were speaking, David Talbot, about Dulles, particularly his focus, his infatuation, really, with the state of the left in Europe. And, you know, Alan Dulles is really kind of dyed in the wool cold warrior, vehemently anti-communist. And of course, the period of the late 40s, 1950s, and certainly the beginning of the 1950s, we see the rise of the second great American Red Scare. Can you talk a little bit about how this radical ideology of anti-communism really shaped Dulles and his behaviors through the decade?
My argument in the book is that that anti-communist so-called witch hunt, the blacklist, the McCarthy era, particularly in the beginning, was really aimed at not so much the organized left, the Communist Party, although, of course, that became a target soon enough, but really was aimed at rooting out the legacy of Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal, because that was the main impediment to the rule of the Dulles wing of the Republican Party. And Tom Dewey, who was their main candidate first and later Richard Nixon and Dwight Eisenhower. So the problem, you see, was that the New Deal was still a very powerful force as World War II came to an end. FDR, tragically, had himself died in April of 1945. But, you know, his people were still in control of Washington and the federal machinery. Well, that was a problem. For one thing, it was a problem because the Dulles brothers were thought by many of these people in the New Deal to be traitors. They had continued to, of course, have dealings with the Nazi enemy during the war, and particularly corporate German forces. And there were a number of people who wanted the Dulles brothers to actually be brought to trial for treason after the war. Well, the Dulles brothers knew that was a real political threat. So the way they handled that was to strike back. The best defense is a good offense. And their offense was to start alleging that FDR's government and then Truman's government was riddled with communist spies and Soviet sympathizers, all of which was, of course, a political exaggeration, but they exploited that to great effect. And one of their first allies, of course, in this mission of rooting out the New Deal and eliminating it so there could be a Republican takeover of Washington, is Richard Nixon, who emerges from the war as a young lawyer, a Navy lawyer, and according to one account I have in my book, came across things in his job going through war records that showed that the Dulles brothers had indeed committed treason during the war. And according to one account, in return for covering that up, the Dulles brothers, with all their financial connections on the East Coast, agreed to support Dick Nixon's first run for political office for Congress in Southern California. And suddenly this obscure political unknown in Southern California has all this money and backing from these corporate heavyweights. By the way, his opponent, of course, was a symbol of the New Deal, a young, charismatic guy named Jerry Voris, who was a staunch New Deal advocate, in fact, was advocating policies that were very threatening to corporate America, nationalizing the oil industry and the banking industry, among other things, extending the Social Security system as a safety net throughout American society. So he was an enemy of the oil companies and of the big banks, and they knew he had to go, and Dick Nixon was their vehicle to do that. And as soon as they install Dick Nixon successfully in office in Washington, that's really the beginning of the sort of Dulles Brothers sponsored witch hunt that does begin to clean Washington out of these New Deal Democratic elements.
I was prompted to look up Jerry Voris just to see his background. It was a Democratic district, and Nixon took him on with tons of money and calling him a communist, literally, even though he admitted he didn't think he really was, but implying that he was in support of that and using that agenda to win a seat. And then, of course, once he gets there, he's really supported by Dulles and ends up running with Eisenhower as vice president. It was quite an amazing fast rise story, and fully manipulated by the Dulles brothers.
Yeah, and then the Dulles brothers collaborating with Nixon during the Alger Hiss trials. Alger Hiss was another, of course, New Deal official that they accused of being a spy and a communist, a traitor. And the Dulles brothers fed Nixon, who was running that congressional witch hunt, a lot of inside information about Hiss and so on. And Nixon, in return, protected the Dulles brothers because, in fact, John Foster Dulles had been one of the sponsors of Alger Hiss's rise in Washington. Just going back to Jerry Voris, the young congressman who Nixon defeated with Dulles money, you know, that's a pattern because Jerry Voris was particularly threatening because he had been one of them. He came from a well-to-do family. I think his father had been an automobile executive. He'd gone to all the best schools, the Ivy League schools. But then he'd become a socialist during the Great Depression, as many people saw the suffering all around, and he became a committed socialist and then joined the Democratic Party and became a very important member of the left wing of the Democratic Party. And as I say, advocating some truly radical and progressive ideas that would be even radical by today's standards. That was very much like FDR himself, who, of course, was called a class traitor, from the same background as the Dulles crowd, but again, someone who broke away from that crowd to realize, no, we have to pursue other policies to make sure that all Americans are taken care of. And that goes up right through JFK. Again, someone who the Dulles brothers thought should have been an ally of theirs, but broke away to challenge their Cold War thinking and their thinking on civil rights and so on. And it's these ruptures that I find so fascinating in my book within the power elite, where you have, you know, the Dulles crowd on one side versus a Roosevelt or a Kennedy and so on.
The formation of the CIA was in detail planned with Dulles and insiders. Talk a little bit about how that all evolved and how they kind of undermined Truman or misrepresented and then continued this very heavy Cold War agenda inside the CIA once it was created.
Dulles was not formally part of the CIA at that point. He was not the first director, but he really was instrumental in sort of lobbying and working in the shadows to make it happen and to push it through and to push this very aggressive concept of what the CIA should be, which was in direct, as we said, contradiction to what Truman himself wanted. Truman just wanted an intelligence gathering outfit, not some kind of armed paramilitary group that went around the world doing all sorts of violent mischief. So he was kept in the dark, essentially, through much of this. He didn't know the full extent of it. Dulles later confronted him after he wrote this famous op-ed piece that I referred to earlier in the Washington Post, Truman criticizing the CIA as a Frankenstein out of control. And Dulles said, no, don't you remember you wanted it to be a very strong arm of American foreign policy? You wanted it to be doing all these aggressive things. He flew down to Independence, Missouri, where Harry Truman was retired, and confronted the old man and tried to get him to retract this article that he'd written for the Washington Post. But Truman, of course, was a notoriously stubborn guy, and he stood his ground and said, no, that's exactly what I meant to write. So Dulles went back to Washington Washington and did the next best thing, which is what intelligence guys do. If you can't change the reality, you change the record. So he wrote a letter to the general counsel of the CIA, this is Dulles, saying, oh, I was just down in Missouri, I met with the former president, and he was very confused about what he'd written. He had no intention of actually criticizing the CIA this strongly, and, you know, I've cleared it up now. So Dulles presents Truman, in other words, as some kind of senile guy who doesn't know what he's writing or has been put up to it by a mischievous deputy, and that, of course, becomes the official CIA record on Truman.
David Talbot, that's a grand Orwellian propaganda campaign there in terms of revisionism and spin. Pretty remarkable that we see this, of course, in the Cold War, but I'm interested in hearing about your take on an historical analogy or comparison, if you will. Of course, there'd be contrast. History may not repeat, but perhaps it rhymes. When you're looking at the Dulles brothers and you're looking at this period in the early CIA and, you know, some of the things that you're describing here, how would you link perhaps the foreshadowing ideologically of, say, what's happening here post-World War II with the Dulles brothers with what we see after the collapse of the Soviet Union with the rise of neoconservatives and Project for New American Century?
I think there's an intellectual through line throughout those two periods, throughout this history of post-war America, where you have this certain group of men who are representing America's corporate interests overseas. That's what the Dulles brothers essentially were. They were the enforcers for America's corporate interests, starting with when they were Wall Street lawyers and then up through their time in national security in Washington. And that same through line, seeing very aggressive concept of America's role in the world, that it should take a dominating position throughout the world, that American corporate interests must be defended militarily and through covert means whenever necessary, the sense that America is the world's policeman and guardian. That ideology, which was very strong among the Dulles crowd, you see, of course, among the neocons as well, and the people who thought, whether it's Wolfowitz or Richard Pearl or Dick Cheney, that we could simply go into the Middle East and break it and kind of rebuild it in our own image. And we're still dealing with the enormous tragedy of that and the invasion of Iraq. And they did break it, but it was never fixed. So it's this imperial arrogance. It's this quick and easy access to the incredibly terrifying, violent machinery that America has at its disposal. That is the through line throughout this entire history.
It's also the case, David Talbot, past is prologue in some ways, and it's really important that people know this history, and I think that you should be commended for how much you have in this single volume. It's really fascinating history. It's really a big part of America's post-World War II hegemonic narrative. I think it's very important that your book is being widely read, and you're talking openly about America's secret government. Of course, that's what Bill Moyers had talked about, you know, years ago, and certainly Peter Dale Scott calls it the deep state. You've referenced the power elites and certainly C. Wright Mills of that period. We're going to need to take a very quick break here, but we want to come back, David Talbot, and we want to talk to you more about some of those strands and some about what you mean by secret government. We're speaking with author David Talbot. His new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA and the Rise of America's Secret Government. We'll continue that conversation after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America's Secret Government. We're joined by best-selling author David Talbot. David Talbot, just before the break, we talked about the rise of this secret government, and it's certainly been the topic of several others over the years, from Peter Dale Scott, more recently Mike Lofgren, a former Republican staffer, kind of has a different take maybe on deep state a little bit, though Peter Dale Scott certainly quotes him in his new work. What's your take on this secret government, David Talbot?
Well, I think there is one. And I think it has its roots back in this Dulles era when it really becomes very sophisticated. These are men who, as I say, had high positions on Wall Street. They were in the oil industry. They were in the national security world. And they often exchanged jobs. They moved back and forth between Wall Street and Washington. They belonged to the same organizations like the Council on Foreign Relations in New York, where they worked out their ideas and their policies, whether it was to drop bombs, nuclear bombs on Japan, or whether it's to overthrow the government in Guatemala and Iran. These were all talked about behind closed doors before they became official Washington policy. And at the heart of this world are these men who are particularly good at sort of tying together the interests, coalescing the interests of that power network. And the Dulles brothers were at the top of that sort of food chain, quite comfortable in all different aspects of that power network, whether it was hanging out with Texas oil men who were their clients, or going overseas and dealing with dictators, or in the New York Wall Street world. And they were very tied into the New York corporate media. Henry Luce, the founder of one of the greatest media empires in American history, the Time Life Empire, was a close friend of theirs. They vacationed together. He was on first name terms or nickname terms with the heads of New York Times, the Washington Post. If there were a New York Times reporter who the CIA objected to because of their coverage, say, of the Guatemala coup that was being engineered by the CIA, Alan Dulles could call up the editors of the New York Times and say, get rid of this guy, but get him out of Guatemala, and so he'd be moved to Mexico. You know, I found after the Warren Report came out a very disturbing letter from the Newsweek bureau chief, the Washington bureau chief, saying, "Dear Mr. Dulles, thank you so much for helping to direct our coverage of the Warren Report. We couldn't have done it under such a tight deadline without your help." So here they are going to the former director of the CIA who sat on the Warren Commission, in fact, was such a dominant figure that some people thought it should have been called the Dulles Commission. And the head of the Newsweek Washington Bureau is thanking him profusely for basically taking charge of their coverage of the Warren Report, kind of a conflict of interest. So this was the kind of influence that men like Dulles had.
We just are remembering the Kennedy assassination 52 years later, and let's get right to the chase here. Alan Dulles becomes director of the CIA. Many of the people that work for him had been working with him in OSS and even outside of the CIA in spy networks and private money that was used. The Rockefellers providing some of that. And ultimately, there's a clash between that core group of power elites, would be C. Wright Mills' term, and the Kennedy administration. And for many, there was a coup. Kennedy was assassinated, and a coup took place, and Johnson became president, who was more friendly to their interests. To what extent do you believe the CIA and Dulles had pre-knowledge and were actively involved in killing Kennedy?
Well, I think, number one, you put your finger on it, you have to see that there was a motive, and that for a long time was resisted by establishment historians. I began to really push this issue with my earlier book, Brothers, about the Kennedy presidency, and I take it even further in my new book, The Devil's Chessboard. Look, there was a split in the Kennedy presidency. There's no doubt about it now. And even, you know, sort of conventional historians like Robert Dallek are coming around to my point of view finally. There was a bitter split between the Kennedy White House, which was trying its best to lead the country out of the Cold War. JFK was terrified at the prospect of a potential nuclear war breaking out. We came, of course, terrifyingly close to this in October 1962 with the Cuban Missile Crisis. And particularly from then on, JFK is very intent on opening back channels, negotiating with Khrushchev in the Soviet Union and with Fidel Castro in Havana. In fact, the citizen diplomat, James Donovan, who's portrayed by Tom Hanks in the new Spielberg film, Bridge of Spies, was tapped by Kennedy to not only get the release of the downed U-2 pilot, Francis Gary Powers, in Berlin, but also to go to Havana and work with Castro to establish a peace deal with him as well. And the CIA found out about this and went to Donovan before one of his trips to Havana and said, hey, we hear Fidel likes to go scuba diving. Why don't you take him this wetsuit? Well, it turned out, unknown to Donovan, the wetsuit had been poisoned in CIA labs, and they were using Donovan, this peace envoy for Kennedy, to try to kill Castro. So they were constantly trying to subvert Kennedy's peace efforts. This was a bitter break within the Kennedy presidency. And my book, I think, goes to the next step in a very convincing way and says, well, look, after Dulles is fired following the Bay of Pigs disaster by Kennedy, he goes home to Georgetown, and he continues to operate as if he's still running the CIA. This is an astonishing fact that I make very clear in my book. He continues to meet with his top deputies, and among the people that Dulles is meeting with in so-called retirement are some very suspicious characters who are later connected to the Kennedy assassination by no less than Congress, by the House Assassinations Committee during their own investigation in the 1970s, which people have forgotten, did indeed conclude that Kennedy was killed by a conspiracy. You know, one of the chief people, I think, of interest that I bring out in my book that Dulles remained in touch with was his top assassin, the guy he'd put in charge of killing Castro, working with the mafia, a guy named Bill Harvey. Well, Bill Harvey is spotted by his deputy. Harvey was stationed in Rome in summer of 63, flying to Dallas from Rome shortly before the assassination of the president. And when his deputy confronted him saying, why are you going to Dallas? He was very evasive. He's just one of a number of people now that we can pinpoint who were in Dallas, people who were part of the CIA assassination team created by Alan Dulles. It's absolutely clear to me after years and years of research on this and talking to people in the intelligence community, going through the documents, that the assassination team that Alan Dulles created to kill foreign leaders like Lumumba in Congo, like Castro in Cuba, was brought home by Dulles and his group in November 63 to kill our own president.
That's a remarkable series of events you've described, David Talbot. You write in your book that you say that there's no evidence per se that reigning corporate figures like Rockefeller were part of the plot against Kennedy or had some foreknowledge of it. But you go on to say that there's ample evidence of overwhelming hostility toward Kennedy. Certainly historian Peter Kuznick has written about this, Oliver Stone obviously as well. There was hostility to Kennedy in corporate circles, in the mafia, among Cuban expats. And you say a surging antagonism certainly emboldened Dulles and other national security enemies of the president. I'm reading from your book, Devil's Chessboard, right now. And you say if the assassination of President Kennedy was indeed an establishment crime, as University of Pittsburgh sociologist Professor Donald Gibson suggested, there is even more reason to see the official investigation as an establishment cover-up. And so I wanted to jump here briefly and talk about Dulles's role, not only the increasing hostility between Kennedy and Dulles. Kennedy at one point said he wanted to splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces and scatter it into the winds. And then Dulles has a significant role in the investigation. So you just kind of marched us up through this serious closeness, this role that Dulles has coming up to the Kennedy assassination, and his role continues after the assassination.
Yeah, I mean, how convenient is this? A guy who was a bitter enemy of Kennedy, who continues to meet with his top CIA deputies, even after Kennedy has fired him, to determine policies that subvert the Kennedy policy, and we could go into examples of that, and is meeting with some of the people who are cutthroats, like a guy named Paulino Sierra Martinez, who was a thug from Cuba, Cuban exile, later connected by the Secret Service to a plot against JFK. This is the former director of the CIA meeting with people like this. So, yeah, very suspicious activities after he's fired by Kennedy, up through the weekend of the actual assassination, when Dulles, supposedly retired, private citizen, is not at home watching TV like the rest of us. He's, in fact, at a remote CIA facility 2 years after being pushed out of the CIA in Northern Virginia, known as the Farm, that he had set up as an alternate command center. And Dan Hardway, who was one of the best investigators for the House Select Committee on Assassinations back in the 1970s, basically said that he was using it that weekend as an alternate command post, monitoring the events in Dallas. And then he ends up, this figure, who should have been a figure of suspicion, Alan Dulles, in the crime itself, basically helping to run the investigation. He became such a dominant member, as I said, of the Warren Commission that people thought it should have been called the Dulles Commission. Earl Warren was a figurehead. The dominating figures on that commission were Dulles and his close friend John McCloy, who was another Wall Street banker and national security type. And Jerry Ford, who was a very ambitious young congressman who's basically the FBI's man and their eyes and ears on the commission. So it was those three people, if you go through the transcripts, if you go through the hearings that are really driving the inquiry, that are making the key decisions, and so on. And Dulles, among other things, was very skilled at directing or misdirecting the investigation away from anything that touched on U.S. intelligence and anything that connected Lee Harvey Oswald to U.S. intelligence.
Indeed. So there's manipulation in terms of where the investigation goes, what the commission is able to do. Again, as earlier when I was drawing a modest analogy between the rise of the Dulles brothers and America's secret government with some of the neocon activities in the Project for New American Century prior to 9/11, I also can't help but draw more connection between Dulles's role in the Warren Commission and the Bush administration insider, more deep state control of the 9/11 Commission with people like Philip Zelikow, where most of the questions that the victims' families submitted were never asked. Even the two commissioners at the commission said that the outcome was flawed. The lead attorney who was counsel to the 9/11 Commission said it was a whitewash from start to finish. And I'm not opening up a can of 9/11 here. What I'm just talking about, again, is this past is prologue and the significant historical influence that deep state operators have over what ought be the public government, a government working for transparency and to show the public good. And what we see over and over again is more behind-the-scenes manipulation and construction of historical record that is not necessarily buttressed by all the facts. And in fact, the public usually doesn't even get to see most of the facts.
No, you're absolutely right. These are tightly choreographed official exercises, not in getting at the truth, but in covering up embarrassing or incriminating details about what happened and packaging this into a palatable story that's generally a fairy tale. And so we've gotten the fairy tale that Lee Harvey Oswald, this lone, deranged killer, resentful of the president, even though he wasn't a very good shot and was using a faulty World War II era rifle, pulled off the marksman's feat of the century. Even though the surgeons who worked on the mortally wounded president at Parkland Memorial Hospital later, when they felt safe late in their careers, testified that they saw clear evidence of wounds from the front in the president's throat as well as from the back, thereby obviously proving there was a conspiracy, that he was being fired on from multiple directions. I've interviewed people who were in that motorcade. I've read their transcripts and their oral histories, whether it was people like Dave Powers or Kenny O'Donnell, who served in the Kennedy White House. They all knew they were caught in a crossfire. That was obvious. Bobby Kennedy, the president's brother, attorney general, my earlier book was all about what he did to try to investigate Dulles. He knew right away what had happened. I've been told by one person after the next in the Kennedy family or in the Kennedy circle that Kennedy figured out, Bobby Kennedy, it was a CIA hit. And that they used the mafia to do some of their dirty work. Like Jack Ruby was a mafia errand boy, Bobby Kennedy figured this out within 24 hours. And he was used to silence Lee Harvey Oswald, because Oswald, who was what he said he was, a patsy, but knew too much, and they weren't going to let him get anywhere near a courtroom. So he had to be silenced right away. So this mafia errand boy was sent by, I think, the U.S. intelligence people behind this to kill Oswald. This was all known within the people who were in the know. Charles de Gaulle, I go into his story. He, too, was the target of multiple assassination efforts by right-wing elements within his military who were backed by the CIA. He later said, coming home from Washington after the funeral of President Kennedy, he told his information minister, Kennedy was killed by the same U.S. national security forces that targeted me, but the American system will never let this truth come out. It's too traumatic. So, again, people in the know were telling this to each other. They just didn't want to let the American people in on the secret. The American people, though, in their wisdom, in poll after poll for the last 50 years, have said that they don't buy the Warren Report. They don't buy the lone gunman thing, and they know something else happened in Dallas.
Indeed, David Talbot, and as historian and political scientist Michael Parenti has long wrote, going back to History is Mystery, quote, those engaged in manufacturing of history often introduce distortions at the point of origin well before the history is written or even played out. And this initial process of control is not usually left to chance, but is regularly pursued by interested parties who are situated to manipulate the record.
And they're doing it with my book. Whenever there's an explosive book that comes out by a best-selling writer like myself or a film like an Oliver Stone, the propaganda machine within the intelligence world has to respond. And they usually do it by flooding the zone, as they say, use a football term, with false information, with disinformation. In the case of my book, right before it was published a couple weeks ago, suddenly the CIA leaked some documents that they've been holding back that pointed to Castro as the culprit behind the murder of JFK. Well, this is the oldest disinformation line, literally the oldest one in the book. The CIA began promoting this lie while the president's body was still warm. That, in fact, some people think was part of the plot to instigate a U.S. invasion. We know for a fact that JFK had opened, as I said earlier, peace channels with Fidel Castro. Castro was very excited about this development. In fact, at the very moment that President Kennedy was being shot down in Dallas, Castro was meeting with a peace envoy from Kennedy, a French journalist named Jean Daniel, who had come to Havana with an olive branch from Kennedy, who he just met with in the White House. And Castro was crushed by the news that he heard from Dallas. He and Daniel sitting there, he said, this is terrible. This changes everything. And then he said, now watch, they're going to try to pin this on me. And of course, the next report, CIA manipulated report from America, is linking Lee Harvey Oswald to Cuba through the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. So this is the way they work. It's a wilderness of mirrors, to use that famous expression from T.S. Eliot that James Angleton, who was head of counterintelligence under Dulles for the CIA, he was a brilliant man. He kind of was a poet of espionage. He would create these alternate realities, this confusion, these deceptions. They sent out the CIA memos to their assets, and we know that there were many, many CIA assets in the media, particularly in those days, and they were instructed how to mislead people about the Kennedy assassination in these CIA memos.
David Talbot, that's exactly what I was just going to ask you about next, was the CIA document 1035-960. You can read it at JFK Lancer. It's actually also the topic of Lance DeHaven-Smith's book on conspiracy theory in America. That's actually the launching by the CIA through their Operation Mockingbird assets, the notion that anybody that challenged the efficacy of the Warren Commission report should be called a conspiracy theorist.
Mm-hmm.
And a paranoid. And of course, that riffs a little bit off of Hofstadter at the time and the paranoid style in American politics. Again, can you talk a little bit more about that before we go to a break?
Sure. Well, and that book that you cite, The Conspiracy Theory in America, which I just read recently, is a very important intellectual perspective on this and how they confuse and mislead people and how they basically contaminate any critic or scholar who dares to really look into these crimes in a deep way. And conspiracy theorist is, of course, how they tar-brush you, because once they do that, then you're kind of on the lunatic fringe. You don't have any credibility. Who are you to even be talking about these sorts of things? And that was a conscious policy of the CIA, you know, way back in the 1960s, shortly after the assassination, as a way of knocking down what was becoming a very alarming movement. New books, new interest by a number of active citizens looking into this, pre-internet, pre-blog. There were a number of heroic citizen researchers who were doing the work that the American media should have been doing, but was too cowardly and too complicit to be doing. And so the CIA knew that they had to turn these citizen researchers and people like Mark Lane and others into nutcases, because they were becoming real threats and were digging up the truth.
Indeed, David Talbot and Mark Crispin Miller at New York University has talked about the continuation of that kind of smear campaign post 9/11. We're speaking with David Talbot, bestselling author. His newest book is The Devil's Chessboard. We will continue our conversation with David Talbot after this brief musical break. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We continue our conversation with David Talbot about his new book, The Devil's Chessboard. Peter?
David, 2 years ago, Mickey and I hosted a four-hour special on the Kennedy assassination. One of the people we interviewed was Mark Lane. And what I'm finding in your book is more detail about Howard Hunt and his end-of-life disclosures, his long-time involvement with the CIA, kind of a working asset for people that work directly with Dulles. So could you talk a little bit about him and what his disclosures were?
Yeah, absolutely. Howard Hunt is a very key figure. He was part of that anti-Castro CIA team. He felt that cause very strongly. He was one of the real diehard guys. And when Kennedy pulled the plug on the Bay of Pigs invasion, you know, people like Howard Hunt were embittered for life about that. They never forgave Kennedy for that. And he was a true Dulles loyalist. Even after Dulles is fired and is at home, Howard Hunt stays in touch with him. They're corresponding with one another and so on. Now, the interesting thing about Howard Hunt, of course, is that he's known mainly now for being the leader of the Watergate burglary and that break-in. But really, there's more salient information about him than that. And I think one of the most interesting things is that Howard Hunt basically offered a kind of veiled confession about his role in the Kennedy assassination as he was sick and dying towards the end of his life. His son, St. John Hunt, who I find credible on this, came to him and said, look, Dad, you have to come clean. St. John Hunt had been caught up in all the family drama, had helped his father actually even try to dispose of some of the Watergate break-in equipment one night when his dad woke him up. He felt that, you know, after all that Howard Hunt has put his family through, that his own wife had died while carrying cash during the Watergate affair in a strange plane crash, St. John's mother. So, you know, he felt, St. John, that his dad owed him the truth. And so there was very interesting sort of series of conversations that the father and son had together while Howard Hunt was slowly dying in Florida. And basically what he said was this: I was invited to come to a safe house meeting, the CIA safe house, in Florida in 1963, before the assassination. And he identified some of the other key figures there. Frank Sturgis, who was part of his Watergate team, another gung-ho anti-Kennedy, anti-Castro guy. William Harvey, he names very significantly, again, the head of Dulles' assassination team, who we've talked about earlier, and a guy who was also equally dangerous and violent named David Morales, who was another CIA hitman. And if you saw David Morales coming after you, you knew your days were numbered. He was one of their top assassins. So these are the people that Howard Hunt said are convening at this safe house in Miami to discuss something they called the big event. The big event, Hunt later said, wrote in his own memoir, was the Kennedy assassination. Howard Hunt later said, for public consumption, well, I wasn't in Dallas that day, but his son and Hunt's wife both placed him in Dallas that day. They also feel, and he later said, well, I just played kind of a peripheral role, a bench role in the Kennedy assassination. But at least he was conceding that, you know, there was a Kennedy conspiracy and that he was on the fringes of it. So, you know, Howard Hunt did start to talk at the end of his life. The American media wasn't listening. The only American media outlet that really paid any attention to it, in the mainstream world at least, was Rolling Stone, which did an excellent article on it. 60 Minutes kind of sniffed around the story. I was part of that. Actually, I met the 60 Minutes producer who was working on it, and then higher up spiked it. You know, I once talked to Don Hewitt, the famous creator of 60 Minutes, the hard-boiled producer who was the father of 60 Minutes, and before he died. And I asked him, what did you think about the Kennedy assassination? He goes, well, we all knew it was a conspiracy. And I said, yeah? And he said, yeah, the CIA, the mob, we all know that. And I said, well, why didn't you do anything about it? He said, well, I looked into it. We looked into it. We could never nail it down, you know, which is kind of convenient, of course. I confronted Bed Bradley, the legendary editor of the Washington Post, who was known to be JFK's best friend in the Washington press corps. Why didn't you do anything, Ben? You'd just taken over the Washington Post shortly after the assassination. He goes, well, everyone knew I was really close to Jack, and if I had devoted a lot of Washington Post investigative resources to this, people would have thought I was obsessed. It would have hurt my career, is basically what he was saying. So at least he had the honesty, Bradley, to admit that. You know, this is the problem. People think, oh, the American media would have uncovered something like this years ago, that somebody would have talked. Well, somebody was talking, and the media wasn't listening, because the media is part of the problem in this country. They collaborate with U.S. intelligence. They collaborate with U.S. U.S. national security agencies. We saw this in the run-up to the war in Iraq with the phony WMD story, which the New York Times and Judy Miller bought with disastrous results. Unfortunately, the great American corporate media is a great slumbering watchdog when it comes to really blowing the whistle on these things. And what we really are relying on to get the truth are these brave whistleblowers like Ed Snowden, like Dan Ellsberg, and so on, Chelsea Manning, and a few independent journalists who are brave enough to, you know, dig this stuff up, like Jeremy Scahill at The Intercept and Glenn Greenwald and others. But the corporate media, you just can't trust them to really open these doors. They just will not touch these taboo subjects.
Certainly, and at Project Censored for 39 years, we've been covering those taboo subjects, of course, not without taking our lumps over the years, as you certainly understand and have experienced yourself.
You are part of this great system of truth-telling, and that's why there are cracks in the system. That's why the truth about my book is finally getting out. I've been basically blacklisted. The book is not being reviewed in the Washington Post. They said they wouldn't even touch it. They even told my publicist that, the New York Times. But it's because of radio programs like yours, because of social media, because of shows like Democracy Now!, because of Salon and Mother Jones and so on. The word's getting out. My book has become a bestseller. And I'm gratified that for obvious reasons, because I want my book to be read. But number two, because it shows the American people can't be hoodwinked, and that ultimately there are these cracks in the system where the truth can get out.
Indeed, David Talbot, you know, William Casey, director of CIA in 1981, said, "We'll know our disinformation program is complete when everything the American public believes is false." And again, the mighty Wurlitzer plays on there at the Washington Post, right? Not going to cover it, going to demonize your work like they did Edward J. Epstein's.
Well, look who owns the Post now. It's Amazon.
It's
right?
Bezos, indeed.
It's Bezos, and one of Amazon's biggest clients is the CIA.
Indeed, indeed.
Cloud services for the CIA.
Indeed, it is. The firewall doesn't even exist. The pretense is nearly gone. David Talbot, we only have a couple moments left, and I do urge listeners to read David Talbot's new book, The Devil's Chessboard, Alan Dulles, the CIA, and the Rise of America. Secret government. You finish in your epilogue. You come back to James Angleton and you take a look at some of the dying words of this Dulles loyalist, this insider, right? And this person says, the better you lied, the more you betrayed, the more likely you would be promoted. He's talking about the founding fathers of U.S. intelligence, how they were liars. And outside of their duplicity, the only thing they had in common was a desire for absolute power. And Angleton says, I did things in looking back on my life I regret, but I was part of it and loved being in it. And you finish your book with these people talking about Dulles and a few others, that they were the grand masters, right? And if you were in the room with them, you were in a room full of people that you had to believe would deservedly end up in hell. And Angleton said, I guess I will see them there soon.
Yes, as he was dying of lung cancer, he was giving that very revealing interview to a reporter, and that has been lost to time, those revealing remarks, until my book, and I hope that does, again, help put together another piece of this puzzle. So even someone like Angleton, who was at the center of this deceit, the secret government, the master counter-espionage guy, he, at the end of his life, he was a Catholic, I think he had something of a conscience, and he started to come clean.
This is exactly, David Talbot, why we need a free press. We need intrepid independent journalists going after these stories. We need researchers like you to go out and dig where others fear to dig and to really tell these great counter-narratives to counter the propaganda of historical construction that the Dulles brothers were so careful to put together over the last several decades. But as you illustrated, the American people are not fooled by this propaganda. And I do believe that if people read The Devil's Chessboard, they will come even more to the conclusion that there's far more than meets the eye here, and we're looking into 2017 for the potential release of more documents.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have to keep putting pressure on the CIA to release those some 1,100 documents related to the Kennedy assassination that they're still withholding in defiance of federal law.
David Talbot, thank you so much for taking time out to join the Project Censored show today. We'll certainly be watching where your work and your research goes.
Thank you, Mickey. Thank you, Peter.
We want a liberated land supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, cause they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign. That's why you hear the same old things they claim, but change never came. It's a dirty game maintained by rain for capital gain.
That does it for our show today. You are tuned to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. Special thanks to our producer, Anthony Fest, and our engineer, Erica Bridgman. The Project Censored Show airs on over 25 stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. We'll see you next time.
Lies, alibis, disguise under the guise of democracy, politics, and the apocalypse. Got the skies looking ominous. So the ocean burn bright with waves full of poison. Genocide, wars, fall for little boys. And the weapons manufactured paid for by attacks upon the prisons and the levees and the mines collapsing. All the prisons, build the capacity, citizens. In the times for the master thief, combine, conquer, steal a masterpiece. Open your eyes and realize what's happening. Time's running out to reach all potential. If you ain't at the table, then you're probably on the menu. We got that love of the brothers in our